Good day. Today is Monday, 27th April 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel if, once you watch this programme, you decide that you like what you have heard and decide to indicate that fact. Well, as things stand today, we continue to be in an impasse in the situation in the Middle East. The Iranians maintain tight control of the Strait of Hormuz. The United States enforces what is clearly a very ineffective sea blockade of Iran. In fact, I read on Reuters, I think it was Reuters, a report that another 17 ships carrying cargo from Iran, including a very large Greek-owned tanker, have sailed through the Strait of Hormuz without apparently any interference from the US military. A few days ago, the US did stop and seize a tanker after attacking its engine room. But the Iranians retaliated by seizing ships in the Persian Gulf. And since then, we've heard no more talk, no more sign of further ship seizures by the United States. Just saying. So the Iranians maintain their tight control of the Strait of Hormuz. There is a very uneasy and fragile ceasefire in place between the United States and Israel and Iran. The Iranians have insisted that this ceasefire must extend to Lebanon. The Israelis have been very unhappy about this, but about two weeks ago, under heavy American pressure, they agreed to a ceasefire in Lebanon. They have not honoured the ceasefire, or at least the ceasefire has not been honoured, which to anybody who is familiar with the situation in the Middle East and the policy decisions and the way policy is decided in Israel is entirely unsurprising. There has been a resumption of bombing by the Israeli Air Force of, one assumes, Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. But so far, and for the moment, the situation does not seem to have escalated into all-out war. And the overall very uneasy, very fragile truce between the United States and Iran is still holding. Now, the President of the United States has made some further comments. He said that Iran, this was yesterday, that Iran is 3 days from the collapse of its infrastructure system. I'm not sure whether this is intended to be another threat or whether the president is taking seriously the fantastic stories I have seen that Iran will suffer critical harm if the American blockade is not soon lifted. As we've seen, the reality about the American blockade is that it exists more in fiction than fact. I put it as bluntly as that, because it seems to me that that is the truth. So the president makes these threats. He makes all kinds of threats. He's made many threats since the start of this conflict on the 28th of February. But I think it is increasingly unlikely. I think more and more people are becoming increasingly sceptical that he's going to act on these threats in the future. Now, there is another in that exceptional series of articles covering the conflict between Iran and the United States on Sonar 21, the indispensable Substack blog of Larry Johnson, the former US intelligence official. Here I would just, by the way, if I've not done so previously, disclose an interest. Larry Johnson and I, at least from my part, are friends, though, as is so common now in the internet age, we have not ever actually met in person. But anyway, put that aside. I think the quality of Larry Johnson's work over the course of this conflict, which began on the 28th of February, speaks for itself. Anyway, Larry Johnson has written another piece on Sonar 21 in which he refers to advice that he, Larry Johnson, believes is being given to the President of the United States and to the Pentagon by the military chiefs, America's military chiefs in the region, the head of CENTCOM and the other key US military official in the region. Larry Johnson makes the important point, of which I was unaware, that General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, does not actually have operational control over the US forces in the Middle East. These are controlled by the local regional commands, which report to the US Defense or War Secretary, Pete Hegseth, who in turn reports to the Commander in Chief, who is the President. I find this very strange myself. I find an arrangement where what I assumed to be the general staff or the equivalent of the general staff of the US military in Washington does not have direct control of military operations, but merely functions as an advisory body for the president. Extremely strange. In Russia, certainly, the general staff there does not act in that way at all. Just saying. But anyway, I'm not here to discuss the peculiarities of the American command and control system. What is much more important is what Larry Johnson says, which is the chief of CENTCOM, the regional command, who is a US Navy admiral and the commander of the air forces in the region, are both advising Washington and by extension the president that air power by itself has reached its limits. The United States has expended a huge amount of its military arsenal of precision-guided weapons in the first 40 days of the conflict. The cost has been astonishingly high. Some put it at $24 billion. I actually heard that it is much more than that. And, well, though a great deal of damage has been done, though many people have been killed, though on the first day of the conflict, the supreme leader of Iran and his officials were killed, not by the Americans, but by the Israelis. And though a school was also destroyed on the first day, leading to the deaths of hundreds of schoolgirls. The point has now been reached when the US military is advising the president that further aerial action by the US Air Force and by the US Navy's aircraft and missiles cannot achieve much more, that they have reached the effective limits of what they can do. For the record, I think that is a revolutionary moment in US military power. Ever since the Second World War, the United States has placed enormous weight on the power of its Air Force and of its long-range standoff missile systems. If we now have arrived at that point where both the Navy and the Air Force are advising the President of the United States that the capabilities, the airborne capabilities of the United States have reached their limits, then, as I said, that is a revolutionary moment, and I wonder whether it is going to lead to any further future review of the effectiveness of US military power. Anyway, again, I am not going to devote more time in this program to these philosophical questions. So that leaves the president with two options. Either he negotiates or he carries out or authorizes the carrying out of a ground operation against Iran. The latter comes with enormous political risks. It would be deeply unpopular in the United States. There's been a succession of people, some of whom we've interviewed on the Duran, Joe Kent, Jim Webb, but others also, Daniel Davis, for example, General McGregor, no, sorry, Colonel Douglas McGregor. They all greatly doubt whether a ground operation of any kind by the United States would be successful. They see it as fraught with risk and likely to end in disaster. Professor John Mearsheimer wrote a powerful piece on his Substack blog, also indispensable, by the way, saying that a ground operation against Iran looked like a kamikaze mission, a view which the military experts that I have seen all appear to concur on. So either the president resorts to this very, very high risk strategy of a ground operation, or it seems to me he must recognize that he is out of military options. If the Air Force and the Navy tell him that air power has reached its limits, if the Navy itself is unwilling to operate close to the coastline of Iran and is incapable of breaking Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz, if the Navy's sea blockade of Iran exists in fiction rather than fact, as it does, and as I have just said, what option does the president actually have in military terms other than a ground operation? The alternative, of course, is to negotiate with the Iranians, with the balance of the negotiations now having shifted decisively in the Iranians' favour. And that now brings me to the latest diplomatic moves, because Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi continues to be on his tour. He has in fact arrived in Russia. He's not gone to Moscow, as I previously said he would. He's actually gone to St. Petersburg instead. Apparently Putin is there. Araghchi, it is now confirmed, is indeed going to meet with Putin. And there is much talk about him meeting with other senior Russian officials. And the commentary from Iran suggests that these meetings between Araghchi and these top Russian officials, are in fact underway. Anyway, before arriving in Russia, Araghchi also met with the Omanis in the Omani capital, Muscat, and he also visited Pakistan, where he had what he said were fruitful and productive meetings with the Pakistanis, both Oman and Pakistan having acted as mediators between the United States and Iran in this conflict. And the reports in the United States say that over the course of Araghchi's visit to Pakistan, Araghchi handed the Pakistanis a document for onward transmission to the United States. This document apparently sets out Iran's red lines and sets out Iran's further proposals for future negotiations. There is word today in Washington that the president is meeting with his foreign policy and security team in Washington. And one must assume that the president, over the course of this meeting, is going to review with his officials the extent, the nature of US options in this conflict. And no doubt they will also discuss this Iranian proposal. Now, I have not seen this statement that Araghchi, this document that Araghchi gave to the Pakistanis. So anything I say about it is speculative. It is based on what the US media and to a lesser extent the Iranian media are saying. I say to a lesser extent what the Iranian media are saying because as of the time of making of this program, the Iranian media, interestingly, seem to be basing their comments about the contents of this document on what the American media are saying. And the American media are engaging in a rather elaborate game of, on the one hand, reporting the contents of this document, but also spinning it in ways that might be seen somewhat more favourable to the United States. So apparently, what this document proposes is that there should indeed be a ceasefire, that the current ceasefire should be indefinitely extended, that there should be an agreement that the ceasefire be indefinitely extended, and that the United States and Israel, presumably, give undertakings. I'm not sure what form these undertakings are supposed to take, but that they give undertakings that there will be no further attacks on Iran, that the Iranians, in effect, be given security guarantees by the United States and Israel, safeguarding Iran from future attack. How the Iranians propose to enforce these guarantees by the Americans and the Israelis, if they're ever given, I am not sure, but I'm going to make a guess that this might be the topic, one of the topics of discussions between Araghchi and the Russian leadership that are now taking place in St. Petersburg. I will come to that later. Anyway, alongside this agreement, which is not just an agreement for a ceasefire, but for a total cessation, an indefinite cessation of hostilities, there are to be negotiations and discussions about the future of the Strait of Hormuz. And, well, here, this is where much of the spinning in the United States appears to be taking place, because some of the American media outlets, some of the British media outlets, are suggesting that the Iranians are offering to reopen the Strait of Hormuz in return for this cessation of hostilities that I have just been talking about. Except that doesn't appear to be the actual Iranian proposal. What the Iranians seem to be suggesting is that there should be discussions between Iran and the United States, and perhaps Oman, about establishing a new regime for control of the Strait of Hormuz. A regime whereby the Iranians and the Omanis exercise some sort of supervision over exit and entry through the Strait of Hormuz. I'm going to guess that this was the topic of Araghchi's trip and discussions to Oman, that Araghchi's primary purpose in visiting Oman was to get the Omanis to agree to this joint regime of control of the Strait of Hormuz that the Iranians are now proposing. It's clear that the details still need to be worked out, and what the Iranians appear to be proposing is that there should be discussions between the Iranians and the Americans going forward as to how to do this. Now, it's important to say that this is not a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, if by that is meant a return to the situation which existed before the 28th of February of this year. What the Iranians are proposing is that Iran, together with Oman, establish permanent control of the Strait of Hormuz, and that there should be a negotiation with the United States in which this new permanent arrangement, this permanent control over the Strait of Hormuz, is regularized and codified in international law. And lastly, the Iranians apparently are repeating their demand for compensation, that the United States compensate Iran for the damage done. Importantly, apparently, there is no word in this document about Iran's nuclear enrichment program. This topic, as far as the Iranians are concerned, has been entirely taken off the table. The Iranians are no longer prepared to bargain or negotiate about it. They regard their nuclear enrichment, their uranium enrichment program, as their sovereign right. They agreed to negotiate with it in the past in return for sanctions relief. That was what led to the JCPOA and to the abortive talks that took place throughout 2025 and in the first weeks of this year. But now, after the American attack on the 28th of February, the Iranians are reverting back to their pre-Obama era position, that they have an inherent, sovereign, legal right to enrich uranium, that this is not something that they have any need or requirement to bargain about, and they're not prepared to bargain about it in the future. Now, if this is the Iranian proposal, then this is not a softening of the Iranian position. In some respects, it is a hardening of the Iranian position. In the previous 10-point proposals that the Iranians had floated, which had been the subject of so much controversy and disagreement between Iran and the United States. But in the previous proposals, as I well recall, the Iranians were at least prepared to talk about the uranium enrichment program. Now, they no longer are. They say they have a legal right to do it. They say that they're in full treaty compliance over it. Their enrichment program is a sovereign right that they have under the provisions of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. There is no reason, therefore, to discuss it. There is nothing to discuss. The Americans should pay compensation, presumably lift the sanctions, and Iran can get on with its uranium enrichment program as it is entitled to do without further interference. Now, this is going to be an incredibly difficult, I would have said all but impossible, pill for the President of the United States and his officials to swallow. I think that they will obviously push back hard against it. But as the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Speaker Ghalibaf, recently pointed out, when the President of the United States said a few days ago that Iran had no cards to play, in reality, the opposite is true. It is the Iranians now who have the high cards, not the United States. And if the advice of the US, military officials in the region to the president and to the Pentagon is indeed, as Larry Johnson is saying, which, by the way, I strongly believe to be the case, then Ghalibaf is right, and it becomes more understandable why the Iranians are making these demands. Well, unsurprisingly, in light of all of this, the President, Donald Trump, is showing no interest at the moment in resuming the negotiations. He apparently, presumably, still hopes that something will turn up in Iran. He still believes, or claims to believe, that there are splits within Iran, within the Iranian leadership. This has been taken up, this narrative has been taken up by various media outlets in the West, in the United States, in Britain. The Daily Telegraph, unsurprisingly, is running with this story. I, as I have pointed out on many occasions, have seen no evidence of these splits. And a senior Russian parliamentarian, Pushkov, who is apparently a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the upper house of the Russian Parliament, the Federation Council, he too is saying that the Russians cannot see, have seen no evidence of this great split within the Iranian leadership that Donald Trump and so many other people in the West are talking about. There has been a huge amount of wishful thinking in the West, amongst neocon circles, within Western governments, about Iran, that Iran's missile arsenals had been depleted or mostly destroyed in the earlier Israeli attacks, that Iran's nuclear uranium enrichment capability had been obliterated by the United States over the course of the June 12-day war, and that Iran's nuclear stockpile, uranium stockpile, to the extent that it existed, had been buried beyond Iran's reach. That the Iranian political system lacks support within Iran, and a simple push by the United States would cause it to come crashing down. That in the event of an attack on Iran, the defense system would rapidly break down, and the United States would have the ability to conduct aerial strikes across Iran to devastating effect without encountering any significant resistance from the Iranians. That the killing on the first day of the war of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, would cause a political paralysis in Iran, leading to the quick collapse of the Iranian government and Iranian political system. There's been, all of these things have been said, and they've been said with total confidence and complete certainty, and we can see that that confidence and that certainty were completely unwarranted. People like myself and us on the Duran, Alex Cristoforo and I, warned before the American attack that it seemed that despite economic stresses, the political system in Iran continued to command legitimacy and the support of a critical mass of the Iranian people. If the latest polling data is accurate, and by the way, I believe it is, then that critical mass of the Iranian people is in fact a large majority of the Iranian people. And well, we have seen that Iran has the full ability to defend itself, that its missile arsenal is far from depleted, that its drone arsenal is enormous and probably growing and has been used to great effect, that the Iranians still do have functioning air defences, even if they're not as dense and as all-encompassing as those of, say, Russia are. This latest narrative about splits within the Iranian leadership and about the Iranian economy being on the brink of complete collapse, these are further examples of this same wishful thinking that has brought the West and the United States and President Trump to the brink of disaster in relation to Iran. So there are no splits. The president at some point must make the decision. Either he does authorize negotiations on the basis of Iran's terms, incredibly difficult politically, though that is going to be, or he lets the situation, the situation continue. That means a situation that is going to deteriorate. We see growing shortages, not just of energy products, but of more and more essential commodities. We are now getting rumours of a major stresses in the financial markets. It is highly likely, in fact, it is all but certain, that if this situation is allowed to fester, we will see a major crisis in the global economy in the autumn. The global economy, of course, including the United States, and very probably we will see, long before that point is reached, a return to military action, which, given all that the regional commanders are now saying, what the head of CENTCOM and the head of the Air Force in the area are saying, what the various experts, Jim Webb, Daniel Davis, Douglas McGregor, Joe Kent, are now all saying, a return to fighting in which the United States will be at a serious disadvantage in a way that can only compound and magnify and may make more total what already clearly looks like a debacle. So that is the appalling choice that the President of the United States is currently facing. It's a choice that he has brought on himself. Alex and I have often talked about Zugzwang, how there is no decision the President can make in this situation that can lead him out of this crisis. We see how that is actually so. Now, I do want to say something about the financial situation, the situation in the financial markets, because there is a very concerning article in Unheard, the British centre-left magazine, and I believe there is a version of it also, an even further, more elaborated version of it on Euro Intelligence by Wolfgang Munchau. And Munchau has highlighted the fact that the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, has now confirmed that the Central Bank of the UAE and the US Federal Reserve have agreed to some kind of agreement for some sort of dollar swap. And, well, he puts it like this. America's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that several Gulf states, including the UAE, have requested dollar swap lines with the US. In a swap, two parties agree to exchange something, in this case US dollars, for the UAE's own currency, the dirham. A swap line would be an arrangement where UAE can trigger a swap at a moment's notice. But why would they want to do this? The UAE is very wealthy. The amount of dollars it already holds is more than 10 times the size of the US administration's Exchange Stabilization Fund, which would be the counterparty to the swap. Geeta Gopinath, a former deputy director and chief economist of the IMF, says this may indicate that, quote, the consequences of the Iran conflict are far greater than we see priced in the markets. Such explorations do not arise lightly, even behind closed doors. And, well, then we go on to read in this article about how Munshaw feels that this dollar swap idea, rather this dollar swap, suggests that something very big and very ugly is brewing behind the scenes in the financial markets. And he says that the short-term risk would be a new global financial crisis, one which could be triggered not only by a long war, but also a bad settlement, which leaves the Iranians in effect in control of the Strait of Hormuz. This could in turn unleash a whole sequence of crises in other parts of the financial system, for sovereign private debt in particular. And he goes on to say that the situation to him looks extremely bad and very brittle. And he makes the further point that if there were a financial crisis, say one on the scale of the global financial crisis of 2008, well, in that case, Western governments are no longer in a position to plug the holes in the global financial system and to stabilize it as they did at the peak of the 2008 financial crisis. Though Munshaw also says that he thinks that in the long term, the steps that were taken then, quantitative easing, bailouts, all of those things, fiscal austerity, that they, in the long term, turned out to be disastrous mistakes. Anyway, there we go. That's what Munshaw is saying. And certainly the agreement for this swap arrangement between the UAE and the United States does beg many questions. For the record, I think the former IMF chief economist almost certainly is right that there are indeed many more problems brewing in the global economy than we are being told about. But anyway, that then takes us back to what the Iranians are doing. Now, I think from all of these reports, we can start to get a sense of the purpose of Araghchi's travels. Obviously, it was not to meet with the Americans in Islamabad. Before Araghchi arrived in Islamabad, the Iranians categorically ruled that out. Firstly, it was to go to Oman and to get Oman to agree to this arrangement, this proposed arrangement for joint control of the Strait of Hormuz. Then it was to go to Islamabad and to pass on to the Pakistanis this document setting out the Iranian proposals, for the Pakistanis to forward it to the United States and for the Pakistanis as mediators to ask for any clarifications as to the content of the document as might be needed. And then lastly comes the most important leg of the trip, the visit to Iran's great power backer in this crisis, which, as I said in recent programs, we can now conclusively say is indeed Russia. And the meeting there with the single most important person for the Iranians outside Iran, who is Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. Now, Putin, for his part, is, of course, in St. Petersburg, and he's there for a purpose. There are a whole series of important meetings going to be taking place in St. Petersburg over the next few months. And the reason he is currently in St. Petersburg is because there is an important meeting of parliamentarians from Russia's various regional parliaments in St. Petersburg discussing economic and budgetary policies in the regions, the Russian regions. And Putin has, in fact, addressed them in a speech which, interestingly enough, took place in the meeting room of the Imperial State Duma, the first parliament, elected parliament of Russia, which first convened in 1906 when it was brought into existence as a result of a decree of the last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II. Anyway, Putin is obviously there to discuss all of these matters. He always shows that his primary focus at all times remains domestic policy, even as he gives a huge amount of time to foreign policy. His speech, by the way, to the parliamentarians was interesting for all sorts of reasons, but I'm not, again, going to discuss it at any length in this programme. His priority, his main concern in meeting with Araghchi is to understand what Iran's diplomatic and negotiating strategy is. The Iranians have, of course, made their demands of the United States. It is a certainty that Putin has already been provided with a copy of the document that Araghchi has given to the Pakistanis and which is winging its way towards the United States and towards Donald Trump. But Putin will want to discuss this document in detail with Araghchi when they meet. He will want a clear understanding of what this proposed arrangement for the Strait of Hormuz is actually about. He will also want to discuss with the Iranians, maybe not their enrichment program exactly, but whether the Iranians are really serious about their refusal to discuss or negotiate about it in the future. And Araghchi, on his side, is going to want support for Iran from Russia, continued support for Iran, because Iran is now in what is clearly a long drawn out confrontation with the United States. The war, the conflict, is not going to end soon, even if there are no American military attacks on Iran. At the moment, the United States shows no willingness to negotiate on Iranian terms, and the sea blockade, fictional as it might be, continues to remain in place. There continues also to be a movement of American military supplies to the Middle East. More troops, more machines are being sent by the United States to the Middle East, though this still seems to fall well short of the size of the forces needed to conduct a ground operation against Iran with any prospect of success. And, well, Larry Johnson on Sonar 21, in that same article which I discussed earlier in this programme. Anyway, Larry Johnson has pointed out that for the moment at least, the United States does not have a ground forces commander in the Persian Gulf area. And that in turn suggests that for the moment, the prospect of an imminent ground attack on Iran does not exist. So the Iranians are aware of this American build-up. They obviously have to replenish their own arsenals. They will want more military technology, more help with their drones, quite probably. They will certainly want intelligence, more intelligence to be provided by the Russians. Who knows what else in terms of military assistance Iran might be seeking. It might be help with electronic jamming. It might be help with air defense. On the Duran, we recently did a program with the commentator, the superb commentator, Garland Nixon. Over the course of it, Garland pointed out that Hezbollah in Lebanon has recently been operating fiber optic guided drones, FPV drones. This is a technology which the Russians invented and have been using in the conflict in Ukraine. It is highly likely, I would say all but certain, that Hezbollah obtained it from the Iranians, who ultimately probably obtained it from the Russians, a further sign of the depth of military cooperation between Russia and Iran. And the Iranians will also want something else from the Russians. They will want help in terms of the situation within Iran's economy. The Russians cannot provide Iran with the kind of financial stability assistance, the credit swaps and things of that kind, which might, if they were ever to be used by the Iranians, they could stabilize the internal financial and currency situation in Iran. China can do that, but Russia probably would not be the country that would be able to help Iran with those things. China can also provide Iran with spare parts, with all kinds of technologies, with fuels, with things of that kind. But the major supplier of the things that Iran is going to need to endure the siege, imperfect as it is, that it is now facing, things like food, grain, fertilizer, those kind of things, natural gas to keep Iranian cities functioning, oil if the United States follows through on its threats against the Iranian oil industry. And it is important to stress that Iran has only a limited oil refining capacity. Anyway, the country that Iran will be looking to for help with all of these matters will first and foremost be Russia. And it is likely that there will be, and that there probably always are, in-depth discussions between Russian and Iranian teams about how this assistance is going to be provided. But in return, the Russians will want assurances of their own. They will want assurances about Iran's stability. They will not want to give weapons technology and economic aid to a government that might be about to collapse. Just saying. And the Russians, inevitably, when they supply aid to a country like Iran, will want that aid to be used responsibly. This is a completely different situation from the one that we have seen in Ukraine, where the United States and its European allies have provided all sorts of advanced weapons and technology to the Ukrainians, and have basically at the same time encouraged the Ukrainians to use this technology and this military assistance in as aggressive a way as the Ukrainians want, creating risks of a wider war. The Russians do not want to see a wider war in the Persian Gulf. They will want assurances from the Iranians that the Iranians are not going to launch into something like that. And they will again undoubtedly bring up with the Iranians the proposal first floated by the Russians, but now pushed very strongly by China, for a renegotiation by Iran and the Persian Gulf states of a new security architecture for the Persian Gulf, one which would involve the dismantling of American bases and an agreement by the Persian Gulf states, Iran and the Arab states to set up joint security structures in the Persian Gulf with China and Russia acting as guarantors, and also acting as guarantors in such a way that the Arab producers do not feel that by entering into such an arrangement, they risk becoming dominated by a very big, very powerful, very self-confident and uninhibited Iran. So Araghchi and Putin are going to have a great deal to discuss. And it is likely that Araghchi is not going to just meet with Putin. He's going to meet with other Russian officials. Now, as it happens, the Russian Defense Minister, Andrei Belousov, is, to the best of my knowledge, not in Russia at the moment. He is in North Korea, in Pyongyang, where he is having further meetings with the North Koreans. And he comes with a message from President Putin, thanking again the North Korean people and the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, for the help that the North Koreans extended to the Russians in Kursk region, where the Ukrainians were humiliatingly driven out in the first months of last year. In fact, there is a monument being built in North Korea to commemorate the North Korean soldiers who died in that operation, and the Russians obviously want to be a part of that. But in Belousov's absence, there are all sorts of other important Russian officials with whom, military officials, with whom Araghchi can also meet, and no doubt with whom Araghchi will in fact be meeting. So, as I said, all of these discussions will take place, and well, we will see where they go. There has been, by the way, on this topic, an absolutely fascinating article published by the US media about the abilities of Russia's of Russia's drone developments, its drone war developments. And this article was published by Katerina Bondar, and it appeared in the New York Times, and it talks about how Russia is building tomorrow's war machine. And it's a most interesting article because, unlike most articles that appear in the American media or the Western media about the Russian military, this article looks at the way in which the Russians have developed and promoted their drone warfare technology. And it is very impressed. For decades, Americans scoffed at Russia's rigid, centralized military and its inability to adapt. That picture is dangerously out of date. After 4 years of war in Ukraine, Moscow has developed an impressive, pragmatic approach to military innovation that prioritizes what works over what is elegant, what scales over what is ambitious, and what delivers battlefield results over what impresses on paper. Russia is reshaping the future of war in real time, building artificial intelligence-enabled command and control, and, it appears, deploying fully autonomous weapons without the ethical constraints that govern Western militaries. I must admit, when it comes to ethical constraints, especially after the episode with the attack on the school, I always find myself wondering what Western commentators who say this about the Russians are actually talking about. But anyway, what this article talks about is the extraordinary success that the Russians have had in developing new technologies, particularly in drone warfare, with a degree of success unmatched in the West, including in the United States. Belarus undoubtedly has played a leading role in this, but of course it is a technology and a level of expertise that, in his discussions with the Russian military and perhaps with the military technological people, the industrial technology people in St. Petersburg, which, by the way, is a major focus of Russia's military-industrial complex. Anyway, it's quite likely that Araxi and some of his other officials will want to tap into, though Araxi himself is a diplomat, and obviously this is not his biggest area of expertise. Perhaps Araxi will not himself be meeting with these people, but more likely he will be establishing further contacts so that there is more, still more, of this information exchange takes place over the next few weeks and months as the conflict between the United States and Iran drags on. In the meantime, also, the Russians will obviously want to be kept fully informed. They're having to consider their own economic decisions based upon the duration of the war. The central bank chair, Elvira Nabiullina, has said that if the double blockades of the Strait of Hormuz lead to a global depression, then that is undoubtedly going to have an effect on Russia. And the Russians, again, will want some understanding of the long-term duration of the war in order to shape their own economic planning and their trade relations with their friends. And of their friends, obviously China is the leading one, but I noticed that several Indian officials have now been speaking, and they're insisting that India never at any time stopped importing Russian oil. And I've also noticed that the Indians are now starting to withhold information, public information, about oil purchases and oil refining in India. And I can't help but think that this is intended, to the extent that is possible, to protect Indian industry from any possible future retaliation by the Americans. So Putin and Araghchi will have a lot to talk about. Mostly, I expect, they will focus on political and diplomatic matters. But in the background, all of these military, technological, industrial, economic questions will be hovering there in the background. Now, in the meantime, the Russians, of course, have their own war to wage, their war against Ukraine. There were reports this morning about how the Russians have captured more territory in Sumy region. It is looking increasingly as if the Russians do indeed have plans eventually to capture the city of Sumy itself. And there were lots of reports last night about further Russian advances, especially in Konstantinivka, the town that is currently being stormed by the Russians, and about the Russians pushing further and faster towards Kramatorsk from the east. The battle for Kramatorsk, obviously, in the proximate horizon. But in the meantime, the Russians have also continued to talk about the situation in Europe. And there's been an extraordinary interview given by Sergei Karaganov, a Russian academic and intellectual, who, by the way, I've been involved in an interview together, which you can find published on the Duran. And Karaganov is, of course, a notable hardliner in Russia. And, well, I discussed in my program yesterday how the Russians appear to believe that the Europeans are becoming increasingly irrational. Well, over the course of this interview, Karaganov, who is never one to hold back, went a lot further. He said that the Europeans are mad. That was his word, by the way, not mine. Anyway, he then went on to talk about all sorts of other things. He said that the time has now come, given how dangerous the Europeans have become, for Russia to actually think seriously about establishing a nuclear war fighting capability against the Europeans. He called for President Putin to appoint an overall military commander with charge over the Western theatre. I think this means Europe, not Ukraine itself. This military commander is to be given discretion to use nuclear weapons, from what I could see, independently of any political decision by Putin himself. And Karaganov went on to say that Russia should not let itself fall into the trap of thinking that nuclear wars cannot be fought and cannot be won. According to him, they can. I have to say, I disagree completely on the last point. I remain firmly of the view that nuclear war is disastrous. But it was really very concerning, at least to me, to read Karaganov's words. And of course, all of this, or so it seems to me, has to be seen very much as part of the overall rhetoric that we are now getting from the Russians, talking about a potential conflict with the Europeans, and of the increasingly irrational character of policy as it is being made in Europe. And, well, I read an article by a presumably Belgian historian, Leon Vermeulen. I should say, by the way, that both this article and the previous Bondar article, I learnt about them from the historian Jeff Roberts. But anyway, this article by Leon Vermeulen is very interesting, and it says, when deterrence becomes destiny, Europe, Russia, and the risk of sleepwalking into catastrophe. As elite discourse hardens, the political space for restraint narrows, not only in Europe, but in Russia as well. And, well, Vermeulen then continues and discusses how in Russia, talk about a war with Europe, with the Europeans, is now becoming much more widespread. Recent statements in Russian strategic discourse should not be dismissed lightly. In a widely viewed interview on Russia 24, Sergei Karaganov articulated a view that is gaining traction within segments of Russia's policy and intellectual elite, that Europe is not merely supporting Ukraine, but is becoming a direct participant in a broader war against Russia. For many in the West, such statements are reflexively categorized as propaganda or escalation rhetoric. For many in Russia, they are increasingly seen as plain descriptions of reality. And he goes on to say that war is no longer described as limited to Ukraine. This is in Russia. It is increasingly framed as a broader conflict between Russia and the West. References to Europe as a recurrent source of conflict, particularly invoking the legacy of the world of World War II, are becoming more frequent. This is a major part of Karaganov's interview, by the way. And, well, Vermeulen talks about how this is leading to demands in Russia for lowering the nuclear threshold. And that's, of course, what Karaganov also has been talking about. And Vermeulen also speaks about how this is creating complex internal pressures on Putin, who faces on the one side an imperative need to avoid uncontrolled escalation, but who also faces alternative pressures to avoid appearing weak or indecisive. And Vermeulen echoes a long-standing belief of my own that the absence of meaningful diplomatic engagement between European Union States and Russia compounds the problem. Signals are increasingly transmitted through military posture, public rhetoric, and indirect interpretation. And Vermeulen correctly says that this is an unstable way to manage great power tension. Now, I would just add to that, that isn't just public rhetoric. The Russians were apparently appalled by recent visits to Moscow by representatives of President Macron of France, and were shocked by the extent to which, in private, French rhetoric on the Ukraine war is identical to France's public rhetoric, with the Russians concluding that if the French talk and think in that way, then they are clearly not interested in any kind of discussion at all. I've come to the conclusion that this visit by the French to Moscow was as disastrous and has been as important in hardening Russian positions as the Valdai attack was in hardening Russian attitudes towards Donald Trump and towards the Americans. On the last point, I would say that Peskov, Putin's spokesman, seems in certain comments that he has just made to pour cold water on suggestions that there's been some kind of private conversation between Putin and Trump. Peskov has insisted that the only conversations that take place happen between Trump and Putin are disclosed publicly by the Russians. Now, I've discussed all of this in several programs now. I don't think that this is being noticed anywhere near sufficiently in the West. I think the Russians were deeply shocked by Donald Trump's inability to move forward with his Anchorage proposals. And they've looked under the lid of what the Europeans are offering. They heard what the French had to say when they came to Moscow. And to go back to what Karaganov said, they've concluded that these people are mad. Meanwhile, the Russians remain committed to achieving their objectives in the war. I think we are in an extremely dangerous situation indeed. Far more dangerous, perhaps, than people in the West understand. Yesterday, I discussed the reports that NATO Typhoon fighter jets had entered Ukrainian airspace to shoot down Russian drones attacking targets inside Ukraine. The British government shortly after published clarifications. The Typhoon jets in question were British. They belonged to the Royal Air Force. They're based in Romania. The British say that only two of them took off. They remained at all times within Romanian airspace. They never shot down any drones at all. In fact, they never launched any missiles and never engaged in any sort of military action. That is what I assumed. But, well, the fact that there's been all these rumours were circulating for several hours about the NATO air forces operating inside Ukraine and directly engaging with the Russians? Well, to my mind, that also shows how extremely fraught and dangerous the situation has become. I would like to believe that somewhere, some place within the West, there is some understanding of this. But so far, there is none. If we find ourselves in a much bigger crisis in a few weeks in Europe, in a few months in Europe, perhaps in the autumn, perhaps as Slavyansk and Kramatorsk both fall, well, it will not be for lack of warning. That's all I can say. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.